My name is Satya. I don't know most of you. I've recently met some of you. I know Michael Shoho for many years. I used to live here off and on, never for a very long time, but several times during the 90s. Maybe when I first came back from Asia around 2000, maybe for a little time then too. And Koban was my ordination teacher and important influence on me, so it's wonderful to be able to speak in one of his main temples, the place I met him, the first place I did session with him in the in the 91, 92, and so it's really nice to be here speaking. A little intimidating being in his, the place anyway, where his seat used to be. But very not intimidating to have a nice circle of people around like this. I teach a small sangha in Portland, and we sit together in a circle like this, and we have talks in a circle like this. So that's very nice. Recently I gave a talk at the Santa Cruz Zen Center, and that's a little more formal with the rotans, and that was fun too. But this is a very warm and comfortable, so for me, I hope for all of you. And especially because the style of talk I like to give, I hope is quite participatory, and so this makes it easy for, maybe easier for people to contribute and ask any questions people might have. I never prepare my talks beforehand and try to keep them fresh and try to feel the intuitive interests of other people here. I sometimes do that better than other times. And that was, I think, at least partly an influence from Koban Roshi. I never saw him seeming to prepare anything. And he came and he would look at everyone, you know. I'll try to do that now. Get everyone's face. And then he would, "What do you want to talk about?" And big silence for a long time. I was very impressed by that model. I don't speak like him. He's more sparing, maybe more poetic, and I'm more of a big talker than he was. But so once you get me started, I don't stop. I'll try to contain myself. How long is this supposed to be?
As long as you want.
We might have exercise time in the middle.
You might hear a lunch bell in a little while. So, but
anyway,
we often run over.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I often run over with everything in my life. And
does it live?
Huh?
When you run over it, does it live?
Yeah, yeah. Not that kind of run over. Maybe we should have a different term. Extend or broaden or forget the time realm. So I'll talk for a little while, and then maybe there'll be some kind of questions. Generally, when I talk at Zen centers, which isn't so frequent, you know, I speak every week at my little group, and I've talked at some colleges in the area, sometimes specifically about Zen, and sometimes more about my lifestyle, because actually, I don't like that word, in my way of life, because it's not so much a style. Because I try to live very, very simply, materially, and have very, as you know, minimize my impact on the world. I take the predicament of the environment, which I think is the major issue facing the world, not just humans, but all beings, to be the critical issue of our time. And I think Buddhism very naturally can and should have a clear and active response to the situation. So I take as my practice, part of the expression of my practice is to respond to the situation where we are in this time in world history. So sometimes I speak more about that to different kind of classes in colleges. But usually I end up speaking somewhat about my my particular take on practice. And, you know, the challenge that might bring up for other people and the questions and interests that might bring up for other people. And then we can talk about that. So, I got into practice, I don't really know when. It wasn't a big turn for me, kind of a natural progression of my life. But I always think of being in nature as my first teacher, maybe my first and root and constant and always teacher. So experiences, early experiences camping and having connection with nature gave me a sense that there's the world of human ideas and plans and obligations and worries and concerns, and then there's a way to be that is really free from all that. Now, in the woods, I think people have that. Everyone maybe has some taste of that. When we're inside, we're surrounded by, in this case, very beautiful construction, very natural construction, but still it's imbued with kind of human ideas. And we know how it came to be, more or less, and the ideas behind it. So we're reminded a little bit of thinking, subconsciously. But out in nature, we don't have any idea how these trees, you know, science can tell you a bunch of facts and figures about evolution, but really we have no idea how all this occurred, and it's miraculous. And of course, that's right with us all the time, in our bodies and breath. Sometimes we're reminded more clearly that there's a miracle, unbelievable, non-conceptual, cannot be understood miracle going on with just our being alive. And we get too caught up in our plans and obligations, and we sometimes forget to appreciate that. So nature was my first reminder, and it was quite a bit later in college that I actually started sitting and realized that there are these wonderful forms that also can help us remember. I had already been interested in Asian religious perspectives for some reason. I remember a story I wrote in middle school, because I was a big writer. That was my thing before I was a creative writer. And also a runner. Running is a little for a lot of people. I started running very young age, and that's a kind of meditation, I think, for some people. But I wrote a story about this kind of developmentally disabled person, kind of based on a cousin I have, and he couldn't really talk. He didn't learn to talk for a very long time. And one day he learned, he didn't really learn to talk one day, but in my story he did. But I also talked about it like his world became more compartmentalized, you know, and more limited in some ways. So I was interested in that subject pretty early on, how when we conceptually think about things, maybe we lose some sense of this limitless or very broad, vast potential we have in our consciousness as well. But it wasn't until college that I started studying Asian religion. And the first year of college, there was a guy who a town person. He wasn't part of the college technically, but he started this Zen group, and he wanted it to be very not formal and not exotic and very, very comfortable for people. And he had the first meeting in a bar. I thought that would be a really good way. And it was really sweet, but that group never started going for some reason that year, so I didn't start sitting. You know, I went to that first meeting thinking, yeah, I'll start to sit. And then all through college, I kind of knew that I was going to be a sitter, but I wanted to put it off so I could have a little more normal college life. You know, I didn't want to be too weird too quickly. But the last year of my college, the same guy started the group again, and I finally went, and I did as soon as I started sitting. That first time, he only had to sit 5 minutes because he didn't want us to feel pressured or anything. And I remember that first sitting feeling like, wow, we're allowed to just experience our life. We're allowed to just enjoy being alive. At least for these 5 minutes, I don't have anything to take care of, to, you know, obligation. And it really struck me quite strongly, as I remember. And I kind of took over the group. I made it meet every day. I was very enthusiastic. I had already been teaching a class on Krishnamurti in our experimental college where students can teach things. And some of you know Krishnamurti, the Indian spiritual philosopher. So this guy who had started this group, he says, I'm not a teacher or anything like that, but the guy who taught me, he's a really interesting guy, and he's nearby. This was in Ohio. He's nearby in Kent. He was getting some doctorate or something. And he has kind of a Zen theme house. And we should go meet him. And we went and meet him. And his name is Tim McCarthy. Yeah. And he was very sweet and also very gentle style. So you can see this lineage of why this guy never wanted to make anyone feel uncomfortable. It originally comes from Coben, who's, you know, known for having been so accepting of wherever people were and not wanting to impose square bamboo. Making square bamboo, you know, that phrase. He didn't want to impose things on people. Anyway, Tim was, you know, with Dukin Hin with a cat sitting on his shoulder and, you know, very informal style. And he could tell I was very serious about Zen and I was kind of giving up my interest in school. Luckily, it was my last year, so I could finish. And I told him I really wanted to exclusively focus on my spiritual practice. He said, well, you have to go to California and meet my teacher, Coben, because he's the best. And somehow I believed him. And me and my brother went out in my brother's classic VW hippie bus and push started every time it stopped. And I we split up in Boulder. I went hitchhiking to Taos to meet Coben, you know, thinking like he would just be there, like in the monastery, you know. And of course, Coben wasn't there, but Stan White was, and he was very kind and helped me out, and good experience there. Eventually made it to California, Bay Area, and started practicing at Berkeley Zen Center with Mal Weitzman, and coming up here to try to meet Coben. I think the first time he didn't show up, and Angie was very sweet and supportive. And then finally I met Coben and had a good connection. So I practiced at Tassajara for a bit. I remember I was already quite interested in environmental activism, getting involved in some forest preservation work, and I had a doksan with Mel once, Sojin Roshi, and I said, you know, I want to go to Tassajara, but I feel like I have a lot of work in the world to do and help, you know, the world's crying out in need. He's like, that's true. That's a very good sentiment. He says, just go to Tassajara for a year, and when you come out, then there'll still be lots of work to do. I said, okay, that's fair enough. And I stayed for a year and a half, and by that time, I was kind of hooked. But I wanted something a little more. I'm pretty driven, and I wanted to see the original source of our practice. And so I saved up a little money and got a cheap ticket and went to Asia. Visited a monastery in Japan that I later ended up training at, and did a retreat in Korea and with the Kwannon School. Some people know the Kwannon School. Zen Master Sungsan, who was very prominent in the West for a while. He was still alive at that time, teaching. And then I went on to India, did the big India thing and the pilgrimage route, and particularly a walk across the Himalayas up from Dharamsala, you know, where the Dalai Lama lives in the community in exile there. And I walked to Leh Ladakh, which is on the Tibetan plateau north of the Himalayas. Very wonderful place, particularly at that time. If you went to villages that were several days walk from the nearest road, it was like hundreds of years ago. Very, very traditional living style. Traditional clothes and farming there. And just amazing to me. I already had this vision of how human beings can live maybe what was more natural to us than the culture we've inherited in the present day. Maybe a more joyful way to live. And I always thought, you know, our spiritual practice has to do with creating community, sangha, and not just the sangha of people that sit together, but a wider sangha, a wider community. And what we've lost in learning to live in community, because most of us, at least in modern cultures, we don't know that growing up. We're kind of taught to live pretty individual lives. But my experience in Ladakh was kind of amazing, eye-opener. Not just that it's possible, but that there's people doing it, and these people have been doing it for all of human history. And you walk into the village, and, you know, first of all, you're on this gorgeous trail through this unbelievable high desert wilderness. And when you start getting close to a village, you start passing these chortens, these stupas, you know. And some of them have a passageway through the middle of them, you know, and they're filled with painting. And it's like you're going through these spiritual purification things before you enter the village. It's just amazing. Mani walls, these walls made of these, you know, people have chiseled these mantras into these pieces of slate and piled them up there over decades or centuries, I don't know. And we think when we enter, first of all, we're in a car, usually, when we enter a town here, so we're kind of insulated. And then we pass, I don't know, car dealerships when we enter cities, I guess, something usually pretty ugly. And then you get into the city and you have to know someone, or you have to have a bunch of money to get a hotel, or you can, you know, be in trouble, you know, get picked up for vagrancy or something. But you enter these villages in the dock, and, you know, the first person who meets you, they warm greeting, and the first thing they say, oh, you've been walking, are you hungry? If you're hungry, of course, here's some food. And the next thing they say is, it's late in the day, where are you staying tonight? If you don't have a place to stay, you're staying in my house. You know, that's the first thing they say to everybody. That's just how you treat human beings. You know, that was so amazing to me. And all the houses are open to each other, people going in and out, and it's just the monasteries up on the hill above every town, the connection to their spiritual practice and connection to their land and their ease and their smiles. And it was just, you know, I was like, I just want to live here. On the other hand, I knew it was doomed, and it was doomed because of my culture. I thought, my work is to come back and do what I can in this culture. Up to that time, I was very dedicated to my sitting practice, but I really thought the whole monk thing was kind of a waste of time and just formal and extra, and I didn't need that. And I still think that for oneself, at least. But what I saw in both India and Ladakh was people that were full-time spiritual practitioners and were visibly so, wearing robes or whatever, and actually integrated into their culture. They actually had a role. People respond to them. They inspired people. They reminded them of certain values. You know, it wasn't so dependent on how great a practitioner they were. It was their effort and that they were taking that role on. And I thought it was so beautiful. And I realized, oh, priest ordination, it's not about me. It's not about helping my practice. It might or might not. It's about helping the community. It's about making an example. So I was very impressed by that. When I came back to the States, I said, okay, I'm ready to do this. And I asked Coben, and I was a little nervous, you know, what's he going to say? He hasn't known, he's only known me a couple of years, and Coben's so mysterious anyway, you never know what he's thinking. And he said, he laughed. I was like, what was funny? And he said, he's laughing. And he said, finally you ask. I thought, that's a good sign. He said, yeah, so start sewing, and, you know, Blanche will help you, Blanche at City Center, who's still probably helping me do that. Amazing. And I was living here, and I sewed my kesa here. I had a great Dharma lesson during it. So I was full-time, so I didn't have a job, so I was just sewing all day. So you can do it pretty quickly then. And in a month, I was about half done with all the things. And I went up to San Francisco on the Caltrains, and I went to make a call on the, I don't know if you remember this, I went to make a call on the phone just for a second, and I left sewing stuff, actually at the phone. I finished the call and I went back to sit down. It was in a tin, you know. And right on the top was a copy of Coben's translation of Bodhidharma's precepts, the 10 precepts, which is very auspicious, I think. But I forgot for about a minute, and then I went up to get it and it was gone. And I searched for like several hours the neighborhood around that station there in San Francisco for all the garbages. I was like, whoever took it, as soon as they opened this, there's a bunch of black cloth, they just throw it away. But I couldn't find it. I went to see Blanche, and she said, well, you have to buy new cloth and start again tomorrow. So I did. Start from scratch. In 2 more months, I was finished. And Coben said, oh, I think you should come out to New Mexico now. I didn't know where it was going to be. Yeah, so I went out to Taos. So had that there. And then I wanted formal training, and Coben doesn't really do that so much. He meets with you once in a while, if you're his student, and checks in. Leads retreats, you know, but he was kind of private and a little hermit type, artist hermit type. And I said, I think I want some formal training. I've already done the Tassajara thing. I said, I went to this great place in Japan. And he said, oh, yeah, go ahead. That sounds good. I went there and studied with a very famous, very wonderful Zen master there for 5 years. Harada Tangen Roshi. So he's in a Soto Rinzai mixed lineage, officially Soto. They have a lot of Rinzai influence. So he was a younger Dharma brother of Yasutani Roshi. Some of you have heard of him. So he was much younger than a lot of the other disciples. So he was the last living. He's still alive. Last living disciple of the founder, Harada Dayan Roshi, who started the Soto Rinzai mixed lineage. And very wonderful, small, very informal temple, but very, very strong practice. A lot of Zazen. Half Westerners, a lot of interest around the world now, kind of filled the nooks and crannies of this place that was falling apart. I always love the places falling apart. Like, this was kind of had that feeling back when I was here, very beautiful falling apart feeling. Now it there's some traces of it still, but it's been worked on very lovingly, so now it has less of a falling apart feeling. Same Buddha on the altar, I'm glad to see. It always has such a wonderful face. So I did that for a while until I felt I was enough with the monastic thing, and I came back to the States and very inspired to live by the original inspiration, as I understand it, of the Buddha's path, of a renunciate life, of someone who lives very, as a monk, lives very simply, doesn't get too concerned with money, too concerned with accumulations, as we just read in the Metta Sutta. And so Japan is very altered. They don't really have the traditional way anymore. There's not really a Sangha in the traditional sense, because I trained a little in China and Korea as well, and it's still very alive in China. It's kind of a counterculture of monks and nuns, and they're welcome in any monastery in the country. They go there, they're always put up. And there's a certain lifestyle expected of them by the culture, and so the culture has an enormous honoring of them. Even decades of communist rule, there's still... I was stopped, because I was in robes in China, I was stopped all the time, given money, you know, all these prayers and things, Korea as well. You don't see that in Japan, because the Japanese temples have all become private, and the temple priest owns it, and they make actually a lot of money from funerals, usually if they have a large... parishioners. So it's been very transformed. Of course, in the training temples, it's different, and there's still this old sense of training. And, having had that experience, I really wanted to bring that vision to this culture, because we don't have it so much anymore. Of course, we used to in European-derived culture with Catholic monks and nuns that also lived this simple way, and that's pretty much not visible. The only intentionally homeless people we see, we don't really see intentionally homeless people. The only homeless people we see are people that we pity, basically. We ignore or we pity the more compassionate of us, or in our more compassionate moments we try to make some connection. But they're usually people that don't want to be in that situation, and maybe alcohol problems and other psychological problems. So we don't have any visible model of someone really living simply for the benefit of the world. In a joyful way, you know? And that to me was... It's already lunch?
It's fine.
Okay, I'll try to wrap it up a bit. This was a big inspiration for what I wanted to do, to bring this idea that, especially concerning, you know, when we know now that the way we've been living in the modern West, we can't say in the West anymore, in modern industrialized cultures, is not sustainable. You know, some people expected, you know, quite soon we're going to have very dramatic effects. In some parts of the world, there's already dramatic effects. And of course, for some other creatures, there's already dramatic effects. Mostly climate change, but there's a lot of other things going on. And we just can't keep using the resources that we've all grown up using. If we want to preserve some nature, if we want to preserve some semblance of a natural balance that we've had, and now it's starting to be understood by even more mainstream Buddhist leaders. I mean, I heard a talk by Thich Nhat Hanh were saying maybe we're extinct in 100 years or less. And there's a lot of scientists that say less than that. Not necessarily extinct, but dramatic changes. And I thought, well, the Buddha lived this way of life that if we could see the joy in it and the beauty in it, we would also take care of all these environmental problems. Yeah. But in the modern West, I think Buddhism is addressing that maybe more than the mainstream, but not so much. You know, not so much the simple vision that was at the heart of the Buddha's original teaching. It was more emphasized in meditation, as far as we know, to give up what you can give up and realize that the real joy of our life, I mean, the heart of the idea of the renunciate vision comes from our Zazen practice. Or whenever we turn to presence, we realize it's not about arranging outward conditions. It's not about getting things. It's not about being able to fly to the Bahamas for our vacation. These things, you know, yeah, they're fun, but the real joy of our life is recognizing the miracle of our existence. What it is to be free from all our concerns and worries and self-idea, and realize we can touch this place of just being alive and enjoy being alive with other people, with other creatures, with nature. If that's the real joy of life, and I think we all believe that in our heart if we come to sit, you know, somewhere in our heart, then we can change our lives a lot, our lifestyle too, you know, naturally, because we realize those things aren't so important. And then the benefits are endless. There's physical benefits to other beings, but of course when we're rooted in our joy, there's all kinds of emotional and psychological benefits for ourselves and others. So I think it's very important that we return that part of practice more clearly into our lives. So I started teaching a sangha in Portland, and I've been living there homeless for, technically homeless, you know, for, without, I've lived without income since 91. Unless you count Tassajara's stipend, or the stipend we'd randomly get in the monastery in Japan. But I lived without my own place in Portland for 14 years intentionally, and never had any kind of physical deprivation whatsoever. You know, you have to move from place to place. Usually I have a house shelter that someone offers, and I've had a sangha that meets various places once a week, and occasionally we've had a residential sangha when the opportunity has come for that, and we've done retreats, and we also do wilderness retreats out in the mountains sometimes. We bike out there and climb up and do some sitting and walking. And at this point, our little sangha is really thinking about how what we can maybe do to have our own place so we can offer more workshops and more practice and have more regular retreats, because there's a demand for it. And all the things we've always offered have been free, and that's pretty unusual. I've been working a lot with a group called Food Not Bombs that has branches all over the world that gather food that would otherwise go to waste. It's about almost 50% of all the food produced in this country, by the way, goes in the garbage unused. People don't realize when people, you know, Monsanto wants to tell us we need to grow more food for our population, not the issue at all. It's we just waste it. So this group at least takes, 1% of the waste going on in Portland, maybe less than that, probably 0.5%. And we can be pretty picky, actually. We get all organic, wonderful, fresh produce and serve meals several times a week to anyone who wants, not just homeless people. Some homeless people come. There's a lot of free food available, so they go other places too. But we have a kind of community there, and people eat. And a lot of the people I've met for my spiritual group come for meeting them there. So that's been a wonderful thing. We always have lots of food. I can feed whole retreats on the excess of food I gather. You know, whole retreats, all organic food. So that's been easy. But having land is a little trickier, to find land to do practice on. You know, sometimes you find that, sometimes not. So we're experimenting with that. And we're experimenting with forms. We don't keep up the Japanese form so much. We're really trying to find a new expression of practice. That's also in the lineage of Koven. Of course, he knew the Japanese way so much that some of that came, but he was always a little reticent to pass too much of that along, because he really felt like we should make our own, find our own expression in our time and place. So, you know, when my robes, I used to wear robes every day and they fell apart and I couldn't keep sewing them, but I really believed in the original vision of Buddha, that for renunciants we find cloth that's discarded and we make robes from that. And in Portland there's all these free boxes everywhere, so it's hard to make robes because it's completely good already made clothes. It's just endless amounts, and I never have to buy clothes. So I was just wearing those for a while, but these were drapes that my friend Sarah, we found really nice drapes, and then she's a good sewer, and she made this samwe kind of style. So these were my robes. This is kind of my okesa, that's why I'm not wearing an okesa anymore. You know, this was made with those intentions. So, and then I dyed it recently with black walnut. It grows as a black walnut where I live. I didn't do a great job. I'm still learning. It's kind of a little patchy and stuff. But I'm working at it and starting to come apart. I sewed a little down to Santa Cruz. I worked on it there. But so we're experimenting with that. But we keep sitting, of course, as core practice. And we do chanting too, our own kind of chanting from the Indian Raga tradition that I've been studying in Portland for 15 years. And also we do some Qigong and Tai Chi, some movement practices that I think are really important to incorporate. And so we're working on something a little unusual. If anyone... Second warning. Yeah. I want to invite anyone who ever comes up to the Northwest to come up there, but who knows where we'll be. So I've spent now a month and a half in Santa Cruz. I just came for a short visit to my friend Kokyo, who's the teacher down there at Santa Cruz Zen, and we were old friends from Tassajara days, and he came to my monastery in Japan, and I lived with him at Noboat Hermitage for a while. So, and I was just going to visit him a couple of days, and then I fell off my bike and broke my hip. And got in a car for the first time, I think, in 7 or 8 years, actually, to get driven to the hospital. And now I have all kinds of modern technology in my body. So that was interesting, a very good lesson to me about... I've always been very vigorous body, been blessed with that, good health and stuff. And now I've been taught to slow down. And it's been really good teaching for me and how fragile it all is and how we can't take it for granted. So I'm sorry, that was... I'm not supposed to have time for questions now, but please, if anyone has something you want to bring up, it would be wonderful.
I just wanted to let you know that Blanche is fine. She's my teacher. She's 88 now.
Amazing.
Lou passed on.
I did hear that, yeah.
But she's fine.
Oh, great.
And thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So I have a question about money, Satya. So how do you regard our... You know, we have money in our realm. We exchange goods, services for money. Do you have a strict avoidance of?
Yeah, good question. So the first thing I'd say is there's lots of things in our realm. You know, so I think it's... I look at Buddhist practice as a big part of it is we're... You know, we come to Zazen and we let go of everything, right? And we come to this blank slate, or that's where we're directed, of course. It doesn't happen so easily that way, but that's what we're working on, to clear things away. We clear things away to create something new, this new being that we won't even call ourselves by our name anymore, right? We all understand that's what our Zazen practice is. And to me, that has to, or that should or could, expand to our whole outer life as well, and we don't even make a distinction between our inner and outer life. So we bring this empty, fresh, new consciousness alive, and then we say, what do we want to create? So we have to accept what's around us as what's around us, that's in our realm. But it doesn't mean we personally participate in all the things around us. There's also, you know, violence and murder and terrible things that's in our realm. And it is important for us to accept that and realize that we're involved with it in a certain degree. But we don't necessarily participate. We choose what's the best way to participate. So to me, I think it's very important as practitioners that everything is on the table, that we can really choose how we want to participate in this world. And to some degree, we participate the way most people are because we think that's a beautiful, fine way, you know. We all smile, and I want to keep participating in smiling, you know. And we all eat, and I love to participate in eating. And most people have sex, for example, and I actually want to participate in that. So even though I'm some kind of renunciate, you know, I haven't taken a vow of celibacy. Because to me, I don't think the earth is suffering from people having sex. There's a lot of people that do suffer in sex, so we do have to do it very carefully, right? But we have to choose what kind of life are we going to create? And it will look different for everyone, you know? I recommend that everyone take a step towards simplicity, but I'm not expecting a lot of people to live like me, and some people are living simpler than me. I mean, the Buddha was, actually, for example. So I think we should pay attention to the Buddha's example, and he didn't use money, and the original Buddhist monks probably, as far as we know, didn't use money. So that's an important thing to consider. So my own creative arrangement with it is I don't make it. I don't work for it. I won't work for it because I want to do my work as an offering, as a free gift offering. I believe that gift economy is the original way we lived. If you look at tribal cultures, that's how they lived. It wasn't even barter. It wasn't exchange. People just, sometimes they're exchanged between tribes, but within the tribe, people just gave what they gave because it was the way to live, and they were given by the other people there back. And to me, that's the most beautiful way to live, the most in harmony with Dharma. So I try to live that way, gift economy. So I cook food, and I gather food, and I offer it to people, and I offer my teachings, and sometimes I offer other random work, just as a gift, and other people will all, I don't ask for a gift back. Other people, I trust that nature will take care of it. So that's the most beautiful vision that I like to have as my direction. Do I accept money? I do, because that's the way people want to give sometimes, and I think that's important. So I accept money, and then because I have money, I use it. It takes me a long time to use the money I get, actually, because I pretty much just buy, you know, the most conscious food that I can think of. I consider how we eat what we choose to buy very important, its impacts on the world. So I try not to use products that cause suffering to animals, which is basically any product that comes from animals tends to, at least if you're buying it from not doing it yourself. So, you know, I buy rice and grains and things that I can't get for free too easily, and I can support food, not bombs, and retreats and stuff with that. So I do use some money, but I don't work to make it, and I just see what comes. Like yesterday, someone who's actually much older and more venerable than me, who was giving a talk there, randomly I totally didn't expect it, gave me an offer and quite a bit of money. You know, just so these things happen, and I've never lacked for. You know, Dogen even says, people don't read the Zwemonki so much in American Zen. Zwemonki is his more informal lessons about how to live. They read his deep philosophy, which is difficult philosophically, but not so challenging to people's personal lives, I think, in some ways. But the Zwemonki is pretty challenging if you ever read that Shogogenzo Zwemonki. And he says, don't ever worry about money. Don't even work for it. Just practice Dharma and it'll come. And we are so trained in something different, in capitalist kind of upbringing, that actually you really have to worry about this stuff. Something terrible is going to happen if you don't struggle and compete and play that game. But I really believe Dogen and all these other people, and, you know, there's some difficulty in not playing the game, socially really, mostly, psychologically, and that's why practice helps so much. But I've never gone without food, never. Even without really good food. They say bakers can't be cheeses, but I eat like all organic, and I eat a lot, usually I have a big appetite. Never been a problem. So that's interesting. So I use it to some degree. I have a good friend who doesn't use money strictly, because that's his expression of practice. He won't even accept it if you give it to him, you know. He just feels that it's so tied into negative things in people's consciousness that he wants to show an example of someone who just won't use it. He's been doing that for about 15 years, and actually someone wrote a book about him recently. It's called The Man Who Quit Money. I don't know if you've seen it. He's a good friend of mine. We've practiced actually in Novo Bodh. He does sitting practice. But he's also from an evangelical Christian background, which, of course, he's given up the conventional form of it. He's very much a mystic or contemplative, but a lot of Christians talk to him about it. And of course, Jesus did the same thing as Buddha in that sense. They were both chose to be homeless and not use money, so as far as we know. So that's the long answer to that question. But I think there's lots of ways. What I try to, you know, I think renunciates have a role to be an example of how far you can go in a joyful way. And I think it has to be a joyful way. So when it's not joyful for me, I really question maybe I should change that. And then that's, you know, that just goes into the mix for everyone else to contemplate and see where they land, where their expression is going to be.